This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, brothers and sisters. Welcome to another episode of Sapient Thoughts, where we discuss theophilosophical issues, where we give replies and answers to contentions about Islam, and where we provide a robust, clear, unequivocal, strong case for the veracity of Islam. So in this particular episode, we are continuing on this series that is related to or talking about worldviews and the fitrah. And up to this point, we have had quite a long, extensive discussion about worldviews. And we talked about its definition, we talked about, you know, the fact that everyone has a worldview, the implications of one's worldview in terms of, you know, one's opinions about various things, answers to questions, abortion, euthanasia, whatever it might be. We talked about the main components of a worldview, everything from ontology and theology all the way down to aesthetics, how one understands beauty or what are the results of one's worldview upon beauty. And so we also did a comparison of the Islamic worldview with the modern worldview, and we spoke about that extensively. And in the last episode, we had ended off with the idea that every worldview has axioms. Every worldview has basic beliefs. Now, from that point, someone may come now, especially if they understand a worldview, or if they claim that they are coming from a modern worldview or a scientific worldview, whatever it might be, they may make a certain claim. They may say, look, my worldview, the worldview that I adopt, is based upon rationality and not fairy tales. Because you have a religion, you believe in a supernatural, you believe in a supernatural reality, you believe in a God, and so on and so forth, with all of these, you know, things. My worldview is based on rationality, unlike your worldview, which is based on just fairy tales. Now, it's an interesting contention, but it's very important to now, if that's the claim that my worldview is based on rationality, to break this down a little further and understand rationality and its limits, and to understand rationality in a broader perspective where we incorporate the idea of axioms to truly understand what rationality is, what are its limits, and, you know, how do we move forward in this area. So, most people, when they think of rationality, and perhaps if they haven't thought about it too deeply, they basically bifurcate rationality in the sense that they say there are things that are rational and there are things that are irrational. So a simple rational statement is, I am Fahad. An irrational statement is if I said, I am a married bachelor. Now, a simple rational statement is pretty straightforward, it's logical. An irrational statement like, I am a married bachelor, well, it's illogical. Why? Well, because someone who is a bachelor is not married, and someone who's married has ceased to be a bachelor. In other words, they, by definition, are mutually exclusive, right? So you cannot be a bachelor and be married at the same time. Now, that seems irrational and it seems illogical, and it goes against the logical principle of mutual exclusivity. Now imagine that you came to me and you said, Fahad, you can't be a married bachelor. That's illogical. That's irrational. And I was very stubborn and I was very obstinate. And I said, well, you know what? I am a married bachelor. I don't care what you say. Prove to me that I can't be a married bachelor. Now you might say, well, that's very easy because a married bachelor goes against the logical principle of mutual exclusivity. You cannot be something and not be something at the same time. I cannot be Fahad and not Fahad at the same time. Simple principle. But then I respond, I said, you know what? Prove to me that the principle is true. You see, the principle is accepted. You start with the principle and then you move forward. But you do not prove the principle. And so, in reality, you can say rationality can be divided into three, not bifurcated into two, but rather there's three categories of rationality. You have those things, those ideas and statements that are rational, I am Fahad. You have those statements and ideas that are irrational, things like, I'm a married bachelor, you know, that looks like a square circle, whatever it might be. But then you have those concepts and ideas, or those concepts and ideas that are outside of rationality. That they're outside of rationality, meaning they cannot be proven, but they must be there in order for rationality itself to function, like logical principles. This third category that's outside of rationality, we can say it's suprarational. Now, this idea of the suprarational, in the Islamic framework, in the Islamic paradigm or Islamic worldview, the term that we can apply in a general sense would be the term fitra, that which is outside of rationality, and without that, rationality breaks down. So you have the suprarational. A concept like rationality, that's what we call aql or aqli, that which is irrational is ghayr aqli, whatever it might be. But you understand the point that there are three categories, you can say, of rationality. So therefore, you have that which is suprarational, that which is outside of rationality, something that you assume that you cannot prove, but you must start in order for rationality to work. Things like logical principles. Then you have rationality, and then you have irrationality. Now, to kind of expand this out a little bit more, this concept of the suprarational is something that must be accepted. There is no system of thought that can be devoid of the suprarational, or can be devoid of, let's say, those things we call axioms, basic beliefs, first principles. All of those are referring to that starting point that you must assume that you cannot prove. Now, what if someone says, and they were obstinate, and they said, well, I only believe in rationality. I don't have to buy into that whole axioms, axiomatic truths, whatever it might be. I just rely on my rationality. This is a major problem. Because if you rely only on rationality, you then would basically be saying, I need proof for anything that's stated. The problem is, if you need proof for every single thing that's ever stated, every single thing that you believe, that means you need proof ad infinitum. In a sense, it's like saying, I doubt everything. Because the reality is, there is no theorem that can be infinitely defended. You can't say, because this, forever. Let me give an example to drive the point home. Imagine now my son comes into the kitchen, and he takes out the knife from the drawer. And I say to him, look, you gotta put the knife away, man. He says, why? I said, well, the knife is sharp, it can cut you. He says, why? I said, well, the knife is sharp, and that's why it would cut you. He says, well, why? I said, well, because the manufacturer made it that way. He says, why? Now notice, he's demanding a proof for all these, a reason, why? I need some sort of proof, I need a solid reason for this. Why? Well, because the knife is sharp, it's manufactured like that. He says, why? I say, well, because the manufacturer made it that way. Well, why? Well, because we need knives to like cut things, like fruit. He said, why? Well, because fruit has a certain, has a certain utility when it comes to being cut, it's easier to eat. He says, why? You can understand that at a certain point, I would say, because I said so, that's why. Because there's no theorem that is infinitely defendable. You can't say because this. If someone makes the claim that everything can be proven rationally, and I will only deal with the rational, not the super-rational, not axioms, axiomatic truths, then this person's in trouble. Because in essence, what they're saying is that I doubt everything. But why is this person in trouble? Because if you say you doubt everything, you have to doubt your doubt, which leaves you intellectually paralyzed. Now the reality is, this type of extreme skepticism, it's not practical either. Imagine now, you get a call and you have this sort of doubting everything and doubt ad infinitum, and you just doubt everything. Well, how could you possibly function? Imagine you get a call and your phone says, mom. And you pick up your phone, and you say, well, first of all, you'd be like, wait a minute, is that my mom? How do I know it's my mom? It says mom. How can I trust the phone? How do I know the phone is real? How do I know the phone is actually functional? And then let's say somehow you pick up the phone, hello? And let's say it's your mom's voice. Then you say, wait a minute, is that my mom? How do I know it's my mom? I have to doubt that it's my mom. And so on and so forth. And your mom says, well, could you please come? I got a flat tire, I need your help. And you say, well, I'm not sure, I doubt. You understand that this gets into absurdity. No one lives like that. And so by necessity, you have to have something that's outside of rationality that you cannot prove but must be there in order for rationality to work. And someone gave a very interesting way, or a very interesting conceptual way of understanding this. And that is by comparing it to a solvent. And imagine someone coming and saying, I have this great solvent, and it can dissolve anything. Now, that's like a person saying, I can rationally prove anything. I don't need axioms. I don't need this concept of that which is outside the supra-rational. Now, if someone came to you and said this, that I have this, you know, solvent that can dissolve anything, you want to ask them, what bottle will you keep it in? So you see, rationality is a great solvent, but you still need a bottle to keep it in, right? And that's where the term absolute comes. Absolute, right? That which is not solvable, that which is not soluble, that which is not solvable. You can't solve it. And so you need an absolute. So you might have the absolute solvent, it can dissolve anything, but the problem is you still need a bottle to keep it in. So therefore, what we can see is that rationality, you know, needs something outside of itself. When we apply Islamic parlance to these concepts of the super-rational, the rational, and the irrational, I mentioned earlier that the super-rational can be roughly equated to what we call the fitra. And of course, there are other elements of the fitra. So for instance, aesthetic tastes are part of the fitra. Certain types of smells are part of the fitra. Your ability to appreciate, let's say, beautiful poetry, again, aesthetic tastes, are part of the fitra. And you can imagine how this would work, like if you go out to see a beautiful sunset with your spouse or your significant other, and you look at the sunset, you say, wow, that's beautiful. And your significant other says, oh, that's ugly. Prove to me rationally that that's beautiful. Again, there's nowhere to go. So in this particular episode, we have so far discussed the idea of the super rational, and we have touched upon the concept of the fitra. We're starting this discussion on the fitra. In the next episode, we're going to be taking a deeper dive into the concept of the fitra from the Islamic worldview. And again, just to understand where we're going, we understand that we are trying to now look at what are the axioms or the first principles within the Islamic framework. And we said that those first principles is what we call the fitra, or they're part of the fitra. In the next episode, we're going to look at what exactly is the fitra. How do we understand the fitra from the Islamic paradigm? And we'll take a deeper dive into the etymology of the word and so on and so forth to give a deeper understanding of what the fitra is from the Islamic paradigm. So until then, this is Fahad Taslim, and these are Sapient Thoughts. All right.